It's the good stuff.
It's like, is this coffee and chocolate and soy and ice, basically?
How much chocolate? Like liquid chocolate or like a chocolate bar?
Oh, like powdered chocolate. She's going to start using cacao pretty soon.
I was just going to say cacao. That seems like the next phase.
Yeah, well, we were doing it that way for a while. I got her to... She hadn't really had it so good. But it's better that way, because we drink it every fucking day. Like, if you're going to drink it every day, you might as well just have cacao.
Go full cacao. That's just, like, that's just your breakfast, right? That's your complete breakfast?
Well, kind of, yeah. So who did you want to talk to today? You had mentioned John Fell Ryan, right?
But John Fell Ryan could only talk very briefly today, but the L.A. screening of Room 237 is coming up on the 4th of November.
Mm.
So we're going to have him on the 8th of November and go through all the madness that is... That it definitely seems to be gaining some momentum, getting some press. People are certainly noticing it. People seem to want to comment on it. I don't think that it's something that... It just seems like a movie that people are seeing, and it just generates an intense need to have a stance on it. So they must have done something really well with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, I mean, for us, I mean, the subject matter definitely, had I never heard of any of this stuff and I stumbled upon that documentary, I'm assuming I would have reacted to it just the way I reacted to the information that we all kind of stumbled upon. So he'll be on that week. He recently picked up the Kubrick Napoleon book.
Oh, his notes and everything on it, or a book about Kubrick doing Napoleon?
It's like all his notes and stuff.
That's so rad. Yeah, I heard about that.
There's this like $2,000 version of it that is this big giant book with 9 books inside of a fake book.
That's what he got?
He got a different version of it for like $60.
Right, exactly. Okay. That's like for research purposes. I can't help but think of Danny DeVito playing Napoleon and Get Shorty in relation to that. You know what I'm talking about?
I did see Get Shorty, but I'm not being able to flash on the exact...
Him and his girlfriend go to this restaurant because he always sits in the same spot, and she always sits in the same spot because she wants to face the sun as an excuse to wear her shades, and he wants to sit where he wants to sit because he wants to be able to look at his billboard poster of Napoleon while he eats. But it's like, it's perfect. Like, Danny DeVito as Napoleon. It's like, it's funny. Like...
And poor Napoleon would be pissed off at that because he's like, I wasn't that short, you assholes. Perfect little jab. So being inspired, I went online to Amazon and found a copy of the Napoleon book in question. And with free shipping, it was $44.
Nice.
It's 1,200 pages. John seems very excited about what everything entails in that book and how it supports all of the research and the work that he's doing and what others are doing. So I think that could be a really good conversation. Simply because also he's right in the middle of this storm right now, mm-hmm. being part of the film. So that'll be interesting.
Totally. Yeah, I can't, like, every time I, like, find a new Kubrick quote that I've never heard before, I just get blown away by how perfectly he expresses everything. It's incredible. It's always very, what is it? affirming, I guess you would say, like Kubrick quotes. But his notes, I'm sure you saw the film Kubrick's Boxes.
I never was able to see that. I knew it was online for a while, but then it was taken down.
It's cool. It's really cool. It's worth checking out
It's a
just
short
even to
film,
see
right?
that he's just he has like this whole just like at his home, just an unbelievable amount of boxes. All these just boxes, cardboard boxes. And it's just all of his notes and all of his everything, and it's just on and on for days. That's why like the Kubrick archives, it's like, oh, if you got permission, like Rob Agger, whatever his name is, to go check out the Kubrick archives, you're like, oh, stoked. And then I'm sure like you get there and you're just like, oh, how do I even approach this? There's just so much. It's crazy.
I mean, do you think that Spielberg and Lucas were aware of those archives when they made Raiders of the Lost Ark?
But that's what that is supposed to be. Kubrick's archives, the
Raiders
art.
of the Lost Archives, you know? That there's something in there that'll make your face melt. Open the wrong box with the wrong intention, you got some issues.
I love how Industrial Light and Magic uses the rotoscope machine, the same thing that they use for the lightsabers. They use for like that scene and a lot of scenes where they've painted on glass. So there's like all of those boxes are painted onto glass except for the middle section, which is actually real and filmed, but then they combine the two and you can't even really tell. It's so awesome. They don't do that anymore. They don't bother with that kind of work, but that was like had to be pretty exact. I have a pretty good painting to have it come across as real like that.
Well, doesn't that speak to the process involved with a lot of this stuff that, and I think of musicians a lot today, is people who take the time and effort to learn how to use some of this older equipment or to be innovators with existing equipment to get new effects or new sounds, or in the case of films, new special effects, that a lot of what makes the thing itself jump off the screen or pop out of the earphones is that it was that work involved, that effort involved.
Super organic, and you can't really imitate that either. You're doing it or you're not. I mean, you can kind of pseudo imitate it. That's the thing with music. You got all these programs to imitate all these things that used to be actual boxes, right? It's like I got friends that got a Space Echo. They find a Space Echo on fucking Craigslist or something, which is like, Pink Floyd used that and you can create awesome effects with it. But most people now, you get a computer program like Reason or something and it's an option in there, but it's not real, It's different.
Had to go grab something. Yeah, I agree with you.
That bar, you have the whole bar space to yourself in the morning, and it's just the deal. Like, how does that work?
Well, this
It's a
is
work, right?
just a small front room that is attached to the main bar. It's called the Snug. And typically in Irish pubs, of which this building was completely modeled after, this is where the women would sit. And the men would be in the main bar getting drunk. So, yeah, the architecture of this place was, it followed as authentically as possible an Irish pub would have been back in the day. So, kind of like that, some
So
good
women
history
have their
there.
own section to a pub which they go to and drink, or what? Or they just wait for their men, or what's the
I
deal?
think that, if you think about it, like a public house or an Irish, which is a pub, a public house, the men needed a place to meet and discuss whatever the shit it was. And I'm sure I'll get hammered for this if I'm completely wrong on this, but while the men went into the main room to discuss whatever it was and drink and get loud and be probably obnoxious and not very proper. The women could wait for them in this little smaller room and not have to deal with all the pushing and shoving and arguing and saliva flying.
You know, there's a thing they have at Burning Man, and at this point I don't know how many people actually do it, but you chain your girlfriend or wife up all day. and they literally, like, they hang out together in like a few rows. Like, they're literally chained with chains. Like, they're locked up. And then you go at the end of the day and you go and you unchain them, and like they go for it because it's an artistic statement. So like it's like a joke, and they hang out with each other and just like
as long as it's artistic, right?
Well, everything there is mostly artistic. So, but it's just like I could when I first heard about that from somebody who had done it, I didn't believe that people like you actually did this. I'm like, yeah. Why? It's like it's a statement.
Well, hey, we're talking about it now, so it's something. You know, that reminds me of when we discussed that rainbow gathering thing.
Mm-hmm. With Freeman.
Yeah, with the A camp.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's insane. And it's literally like, it's totally, you know, I wanted to refer to it as the Cleat Boat. I'd heard him talking about the Cleat Boat in reference to Disney thing at one point. Who's the guy in fucking Videodrome? I'm spacing.
The actor?
Yeah.
James Woods?
Yeah, so James Woods is in a Disney movie where he's calling up all these spirits and doing all this stuff. I think it was like Prince of Egypt. Was that Disney? Or was that... Anyways, it was some, you know, Old Testament Disney thing. And he's actually saying, like, names of Cleat Boat, like, in the song. Like, he's dancing around in this whole thing. So I was, like, referring to A-Camp as, like, the Cleat Boat, because you're like, that's the shell that surrounds the thing that is the life. Like, the event itself is, like, the Tree of Life, and what surrounds it is A-Camp. And these are, like, these people are crazy. So we drive up at night, we're leaving, and they run out in front of the car. So, like, I'm driving, I'm like, I have to put one of my brakes. And then guys come from all sides and get up on top of the car and are jumping up and down in the car while someone else is in front. And, like, basically they just accost us. My friend rolls down the window to be like, what the fuck? And the guy reaches in, takes a seatbelt that he's wearing, puts it around his neck, like, wraps it around his neck, and then punches my friend in the face. And so, and then there's a girl in the car in the front seat. And I'm sitting in the back seat with my my friend's son, who's younger, who she sent out there to go experience, you know, whatever. Anyways, fucking, I know that the guy next to me has a bottle of Jack Daniels, which his mom gave to him, which he never drank, because rainbow gatherings aren't really so much of a drinking event. Like, it's kind of weird if you're drinking at a rainbow gathering for whatever reason, you know? I don't know if that's true anymore, but this is true at the time. And anyways, I grab his Jack Daniels and jump out of the car. And this guy is, like, singing. Like, I don't remember what he was singing. This is a long time ago, but it was Rolling Stones. I don't remember what. But anyways, he's singing, and I start singing along with him. And it completely tweaks him out. Like, and I open up the Jack, and I take a swig, and then I hand it to him. Meanwhile, like, all these guys are looking at me because I got out of the car, and I'm just like, I'm like, you guys want some Jack or whatever? And like, they like walk over. I'm like, have some fucking Jack. We're gonna go, like, you know. They had put all over the car, like, had written swastikas with It's crazy. Crazy people.
But it's an artistic statement, right?
Well, for them, they're like, what, fucking train hopping, like, gutter fucking they have a whole different approach to what they don't want to go into the Peace Love event. They don't want to have anything to do with that. They're not those type of people. They do eat mushrooms and they hang out and they get drunk, you know, and they just cause trouble.
And it's remains a part of the Rainbow Gathering because essentially if one A camper leaves A camp and goes to Rainbow Gathering and transforms, it's worth it, or it's just if we're peace and love, we gotta take everything. We can't exclude the stuff we would rather not see or rather not have. So is it some sort of completion or
it just developed that way due to the fact that not everybody wants to be part of the event, but people want to fuck with it. And so they don't want to go into the event. So that's what happened. They just stay on the outside. So they're on the outskirts. Garping in and out.
So America is more A camp than Rainbow Gathering.
Oh, I don't know. America's everything all at once. It's like the issue, like when people ask about Burning Man, you know, who haven't been there, I'm like, Burning Man, you can't take a actual position on. And you can pretend to, but you just can't. The reality of what Burning Man is, you can't really be like, oh, it's this or it's that, because Burning Man is everything all at once.
So you have to actually be at Burning Man to make any statement on it.
Even if you were at Burning Man, you can't say what Burning Man is. Because Burning Man is so much, everything, all over the place. You're like, oh, it's a fucking consumer fucking, like, free-for-all. It's like, well, yeah, you know, but it's not like nothing fucking good comes out of it. There was a guy, was it Charles Shaw? I think it was Charles Shaw, the guy who did the not-so-secret history of the drug war. Who's just amazing. I highly recommend checking out his stuff. He goes into showing how, like, basically the government's role and the ridiculousness of, like when Bill Hecht says it's not a war on drugs, it's a war on personal freedom, he shows, like, exactly how that is so, like, and backs everything up to an incredible degree. But anyways, he was attacked by this person from the New Yorker who basically showed up at Burning Man, like, basically a journalist undercover. And wrote an article about how fucked up Burning Man is. He wrote a rebuttal to the New Yorker in response to it, basically talking about all the good things that come out of Burning Man. So they were putting down a few particular camps that they had stayed at, but they weren't, they, you know, whatever. They went there and they were coming from their own place and they didn't really have a good time, but they stayed off on their own. And he was like, you should have come to us, like, to the camp and been like, I'm a journalist, I want to, you know, or whatever. But they kind of were alienated in their own zone and they didn't have a good time. But anyways, whatever. These people provided temporary housing for hurricane victims. This camp that they're, like, saying that they're all they want to do is do drugs and freak out and whatever. And it's like, didn't realize that, like, this camp for no profit built, like, the most cutting edge temporary housing that's been used for disaster relief, like, to an incredible degree. And that Burning Man is, like, just one fucking week out of the year where these people have a different approach to everything. But the rest of the year, what are these people fucking doing? Like, it's like the organizers of this camp. And so they're putting down the organizer of the camp, not realizing that there's this whole other picture that they only got this small part of because they see these people cutting loose. And, like, that's just, it's just this thing, you know, where it's like there's an appearance of something, but there's fucking way more going on. You know, this is an artistic event. 1 week, like, you know.
And how many years now? 10 years? 12 years?
20-something.
And yeah. Started with, what, 500 people? 1,000 people?
Less than that. It started in San Francisco on the beach. And then they realized that they, you know, had to expand, so they went out into the desert. But when it first started, it was super dark too. Like, a lot of people don't realize, like, who go there, that like, I have a close friend who, when he's like my age or maybe a little older, he's like 30 something, 31, 32. Anyways, he was 17, I think, the first time he went out there, and he drove out there. He had no idea what he was going to, and he wakes up in the morning to like crazy moans. He hears these moans, and he's like, "What the fuck is that?" Like it's women, and he's like, "Wow, someone's just like," but there's so many. He's just like, "It's just an orgy," and he opens up his tent. Outside of his tent, there's like this large group of women, all wearing strap-on dildos, taking turns fucking a blow-up doll. Like they have a blow-up doll, and they're all like into it and getting off on fucking this blow-up doll. Just weird. He's just like, "What is going on?" He takes a walk, and then he sees a guy with a paper bag on his head with holes cut in it, basically with this guy with hooks in his skin being stretched out, and they're carving shit into his back, and all these people are like chanting like weird fucking like, you know, as pagan as you can imagine. Like this is what he stumbles upon, like the fucking epitome. And they bring out a goat that's dead and rip it open with their bare hands, rub the blood all over their skin, just like. He walks further. This is all in one, his first day. You know, someone hands him an AK-47, and it's like, "Get on the back of this Jeep, and you're gonna shoot these targets." They're like, "Come on, you know." It's like this whole thing is a drive-by shooting range, and they drive like fucking 80, 90 miles an hour, and he's on the back of this Jeep shooting an AK, 17 years old, at like, you know, targets that they're moving past. Like just completely out of control. And so like, you know, like, and then, you know, I have of another close friend who during this time got a message in an ayahuasca journey. He's with Santa Daime, and he gets a message saying he needs to go to this thing in the desert that he knows nothing about, and that basically he has to bring light to this thing because this thing is growing. And like he gets this whole message, and he tells his teacher about it, you know, and goes off to Burning Man, not ha like basically puts the two together as like this must be the thing that's connecting. Like he's like total, like his personal synchronicity, like he's just like something happening in the desert and I'm called to it, you know. And he and yeah, at that time hardly, you know, it wasn't that widely known, you know. It's just like it's super it's just this expanding kind of organism thing that's just, and people are like, "Oh, it's corporate," and it's like, well, yeah, it's also got all these underground elements that are totally beyond anything corporate, like, and it's consumeristic, and it's like, yeah, but it's based on sharing, you know, and there's no money exchange except in center camp, like for coffee. Like it's like, you know.
So, oh man, you know, can anyone possibly, and will anyone attempt to write the definitive Burning Man book or make the Burning Man movie? I mean, I'm sure someone will attempt to, but do you think
There's
people.
documentaries and stuff, but it's something that's alive. Like you can't necessarily do that same thing with it than you can do with a lot of things, you know. It's like, I mean, even like you make a documentary on something, there's a bunch of documentaries and things that have been made on Burning Man, but it's not it. You experience, it's also like it's the elements factor. So you basically, like, people reach a threshold. It's not always like, this is a thing that's kind of it's not always like it during the week so much. If you show up beforehand and if you stay after, you tend to experience more of dust storms. Like, and people talk like, but dust storms can happen, and you can get stuck in one, and you can be in a whiteout. I mean, I've been during the week been in a whiteout for, you know, 6 hours at a time, where you
Wow.
cannot, like, your hand in front of you know, just from dust. But you know, that's happened more after the fact. Like usually when everyone's leaving, it stirs up the dust or whatever. And this year is like perfect weather. I don't even know, but basically, you get in touch with the elements, like, you know, and you just gets to the point where you just end up loving it, like, because you don't really have another choice. And so you're just in the dust. And, like, I mean, I'll fucking eat the dust. I don't care. Like, I don't have any. It's as alkaline gets, the dust itself. We've done tests. Like, we brought the test out there, put it on our tongue, and we're like, "Wow, acidic. Can you put it on the dust?" And you're like, "Wow, alkaline." So. As alkaline as alkaline can possibly be, that's the dust. And then they did nuclear tests not too far from there, which gets kind of weird too. You're just like, wow, dude, this is like,
That's wild. I can't even imagine. I think at this point in my life, I could go to Burning Man and I could lose myself in it and just lose myself in it. But 5 years ago, 10 years ago, not a fucking chance. Not a fucking chance.
I don't know about that. I didn't have a, like, I was invited multiple years before I actually went, but I didn't know what I was saying no to. The point of people like being like, I got a ticket, you can come, or whatever, and like I didn't have a basis for comparison, so I didn't realize. Now, I'm like, oh yeah, I could, it would have been fine, but it's just I'm like week in the desert, like I don't know what is it going to take. And like people talk about how much money it costs. I'm like, dude, I fucking I what? I mean, I've gone on $200. I mean, I bought my ticket before and snuck in because I needed to go early to work, and I was actually I snuck into Burning Man as bacon. So I was a big strip. I was a big strip of bacon curled up in the front seat, like a bacon costume. And they looked right at me, but they didn't know what they were looking at. They just saw a big thing of you can get in if you want to get in, and you don't have to spend much to do it, especially if you get involved with a camp and stuff. They can help you out. Like my first year, I didn't even prepare for food. And my camp was like totally reasonable and like was just like get us later, and I did, they they're super cool about it. Maybe not everyone's that cool, but there's people that have gone and their project is to literally show up naked on a bicycle with nothing, and they make it. They're fine, so
But you can't do that every year, I imagine.
I have a friend who's ridden from Santa Cruz to Burning Man on a bike, I think 7 years in a row, and just had his supplies on the bike like that he used on
Wow.
the. So that's like,
How long is the whole festival?
It's a week.
It's a week. Okay.
Totally.
And I think I've asked this before, but and this probably goes into what you've just been explaining, so forgive me if it sounds redundant. But is this a quintessentially American thing? Being
Well,
birthed
that's the thing.
in.
It's so far, yes, it has been. I mean, there's festivals that happen around the world, like we're mentioning rainbow gatherings. Like rainbow gatherings, they're American. Americans go to them, and they're everywhere. Like, what's the, I think the next one's in Brazil or something. I forget. Pretty sure. But yeah, they have they have the regionals, and then they have the bigger ones. I don't know as much of, I've only been to one rainbow gathering, but Burning Man right now, the discussion is, I don't know how much I agree with it. I don't know whatever, but Larry Harvey and all these people are looking to expand Burning Man to be a global thing. They want to actually do Burning Man type events in like fucking like Haiti and like totally like fucked up places. And just bring attention to those places and whatever. But I don't know if that's a good thing. I don't know what would actually what they're actually wanting to create or do with that. And it's very tricky. So, but that was this year, we actually stumbled upon, we ended up on a bus that my friend drives that basically does tours for people who just show up at Burning Man for more of like. They say this is the thing. They say that you're not supposed to be a like just observer or what is it? A spectator. It's not a spectator event. Yet at this point, spectators do go. We actually and we flew in people for that were like what were they? They were some crazy government committee members, whatever. Tax dollars probably paid for it, but flew them in just for 1 day at Burning Man. And then they left, it's like, and they get a bus that drives them around, and me and Amy are friends with the guy who drives this bus, so we ended up on this bus and whatever, we saw Larry Harvey, which actually that day wasn't one of the most interesting things of the day. But he had just, it was just explained to us that he had just had a meeting with these people on how to do Burning Man in third world countries.
Jesus.
Yeah, which is kind of crazy. But I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, see how things unfold. I don't really like that's, I don't know. It feels like what happens, which is what happens with most things like this, is like something just develops and then it just expands and it integrates itself into culture and society. But then out of that thing, new things are spawn. And like out of Burning Man, so much is like coming out that's like not even associated with Burning Man. And like that's part of the value and that's part of the hidden hand of the thing, because you see the surface of it, because that's what gets that's what's most readily like available and recognized. It's like you're like, oh, Burning Man, but it's like, no, everyone coming together and networking, all kinds of shit, you know, all over the place. And so
Burning Man sort of developed right around when Lollapalooza probably developed.
Oh, I don't know about,
I mean,
that.
About 20 years ago, because I know the first Lollapalooza was in the early 90s, like 92, 93. But obviously in San Francisco on a beach, it's a much smaller scale. But, you know, Perry Farrell, who organized Lollapalooza, was out on the coast of California in L.A. And that's where Jane's Addiction made their home. So I'm sure with his knowledge and his awareness, he knew something about it. I'd be fascinated to know if there was what the thought process was behind the evolution of those two things. And I think anyone would, whatever, that's just a whole different subject. But what was I going to say? To kind of seg over to something different, I rewatched American Beauty.
Finally. Yeah.
And was blown away by watching it again. About a movie for me that, I mean, it's not explicit, but it is set in Chicago. So it is a movie set in the heart of the Midwest.
Is it like a suburb of Chicago?
Essentially, it's supposed to be a suburb of Chicago. But there's some area codes that are in there, and I think an address or two that would say that it's set in Chicago. But and I remember you had mentioned in the credits the whole thank you to Dr. Bill and Alice.
Yes.
And having that in mind when I'm watching it, it is sort of like the anti Eyes Wide Shut, or the negative image of it, where instead of going to Dr. Bill's big gala in the room with all the people, they go to the wife's big gala, where they dress up and go to the thing, and, you know, followed shortly after by a pot smoking scene, and then a whole sort of change in perspective for the character. And I'm wondering, that had to have been coincidental, that sort of progression.
So on the commentary of, what's his name? What's the guy who did it?
The director or the writer?
Sam Mendes. So Sam Mendes is talking about how subliminally throughout the whole film, especially at the beginning, you can see that he does this thing with prison, where basically Kevin Spacey's character is in prison.
Yes.
And if you look, when he's at his desk at the beginning, where it says "look closer," you know, on his desk, when he looks at the computer screen, there's actually bars of numbers on the computer screen that are supposed to be prison bars.
Yeah.
And that basically it's all a reflection of the fact that this is, first of all, his dream. The way that they fly in is him actually dead, flying in to his bed, like where he wakes up at the end, and there's this whole alternative version that was the original version. And that the kids actually, this is something that I tripped out on since the first time I watched it, that if you look at it, all the implications of what's taking place beyond the story itself, like that's visible, what would actually happen out of that? The police are going to show up. They're going to search the houses. They're going to search the kids, the boys' room, the next door neighbor. And what does he have but a fucking video of him being told that he's been hired to kill her dad, like straight up. And then it's his father's gun that his father, it doesn't like, and at this point, it wouldn't even matter what had the father said, I did it, because there's no fingerprints. The gun's at the house. He's over there. Like, there's nothing.
It's O.J. Simpson, isn't it?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's the first thing I think of when you're making that scenario, because I remember way back in the day, someone saying that they talked to a psychic and they said the O.J. Simpson case is that O.J.'s son killed his mother and that O.J. stepped in to take the blame because he knew they couldn't convict him on evidence.
Right.
But that was the play, that was how he wanted to do it. But whatever, that was a little sidetrack there.
No. That's actually funny. I was just thinking about O.J. Simpson yesterday. It keeps coming up because the we can go into that in a second. So the children end up in jail at the end, and I was hoping that on the DVD that they would have the fucking removed scenes, but they don't. But the boy. Shit, I should know all these. Ricky Fitz, he's singing Us and Them at the end in his prison cell. That there is actually a scene that was shot of him sitting there singing Us and Them.
Really?
Say in the commentary. And that was what the reference is at the beginning, which where he says, you like Pink Floyd?
Yeah.
And he goes, I haven't listened to this album in years. And he goes, I like a lot of music. You know, and I was like, are they, that's like, you know, that's pretty potent, you know, I mean, it's pretty direct, like, in terms of what Pink Floyd has been in relationship to film for so long, like, whether or not anything else, like, I mean, you, like, culturally speaking, you have, obviously, Dark Side of the Rainbow and all that, but The Wall is filmed the same way, where you have this music film overlay. You know, and then you look at like, but yeah, they did soundtracks, but they didn't do regular soundtracks. You have like More and The Valley, like those aren't your average soundtracks there. And so anyways, there's this whole thing with Pink Floyd and film. And I don't know. I thought that was really like interesting. I'd love to see that fucking scene, but yeah, they get convicted for the murder.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense.
Right. And so that's the weird thing, that he's in jail because they're in jail. And so there's this, like, that's the subliminal thing of him behind bars, is that they're behind bars and it's all, like, you know, from their perspective and his perspective, like, at the same time kind of thing. Super tripped out.
You know, yeah, no, it's funny. I always thought I, you know, had a good eye for movies and what was good in movies, but I had a roommate who went to film school at Columbia, and we were watching Fargo, and you know, this is a long time ago, but he's like, you notice how the blinds on William Macy's office look like he's in a prison cell, like he's in a jail. And I just completely, my mind must have been saturated, and it was just that line or that comment or that thing pointing it out that all of a sudden I understood film, or like, I was like, oh, this is how you can watch film also, you know? And it was like I could rewatch all the movies I had ever seen again from this new perspective. And I think that led into, shortly after getting into The Dark Side of the Rainbow and being able to see more accurately what all the hype was about. So, yeah, definitely. That motif of the prison bars is all over that movie and definitely informs that other layer to the film. And it's brilliant how one sentence changed the way I look at film. And then it wasn't like it was a throwaway comment, because every film I watched from then on just completely changed my perspective. Now, Alan Ball wrote that movie, right?
Right. Who's also on the commentary as well, okay. But he doesn't talk nearly as much as Sam Mendes does.
I'm sure he wouldn't want to, right?
What's that?
I'm sure he wouldn't want to.
Yeah, you can see how they're dynamic, like that he's more reserved and that Sam Mendes is the more forward. So he needed somebody like that to like make it's like they have a really perfect dynamic in that way.
You know,
But that's
going back to,
also what's that?
go for it.
I was just going to say you mentioned Dr. Bill and Alice, but then you have obviously Pete Townsend, who he went to through a school situation with Sam Mendes. All his time with Pete Townsend, they're very close. They're like really good
Really?
friends. So then that is also that's the other piece. So you have like I okay before I see this was very affirming once again to see the link between you know special thanks to obviously Dr. Bill and Alice. So you're saying okay, I had connected. I've been connecting on my blog before I saw that special thanks. Alice in Wonderland's painting the roses red to Tommy, which is really weird. And obviously American Beauty. I was going to this whole rose thing and Rosemary's Baby and like just roses, roses, roses. And my a friend of mine had asked me to do, he was working on he had written a script with a few people to do this kind of like series that I don't know if it'll ever happen, but it's about the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk. And it's the basic premise of it was that the boardwalk was designed by Israel Regardé and Aleister Crowley. And that basically is because the boardwalk burned down in the early 1900s. And when they rebuilt it, those guys came in to lay the foundation of basically to set up it as a magical kind of thing under people's noses, and that everything was according to the Tree of Life and all this stuff. Anyways, they'd written a script with that as its basis, and all these homeless people and everything are experiencing this shit, and they don't know why, and they'll never know why. But there's like this embedded encoded thing. And anyways, he'd asked me to draw to represent like as a kind of like a comic format some of this thing that he'd been working on. There was another artist working on it too, and we didn't end up doing that much, but we did a number of little pieces. And one of them, he had just wanted me to write red roses like over and over and over and over again and draw red roses and have this character introduced in relationship to red roses. And I ended up like just doing a super elaborate thing and having to write this poem that said red roses like what fucking 50 times or something, like just like over and over again. And that was like while I was drawing that, I with this is a, like maybe 2 years ago, I was just meditating on red roses, and then all this red rose symbolism started coming up, and I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, in the labyrinth in Alice in Wonderland, Alice fucking just painting the roses red, and how the queen's like off with her head, off with her heads, you know, and she's all about taking the heads off. And then I'm also looking at the Golden Bough, which is really cool right now. If you know, with Alan's book about the King Kill, Marilyn Manson, I had read this thing also, his take on the King Kill, and there's actually a really great website that has a full explanation of
I saw
Marilyn.
that. You forwarded me that. That took me back. That definitely made me have to reevaluate my thoughts on Marilyn Manson completely. I always knew there was more to the story with that guy, but that really kind of drove it home.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things there. I just read a quote the other day of Marilyn Manson on that website, something I had missed, of him saying, "A good friend of mine gave me a tarot reading, which said that this album, Hollywood, is the album that's defining me as an artist." And what do you know? That album goes in sync so well with Holy Mountain, and the person who gave him the reading is obviously Alejandro Jodorowsky. They're very close, so it's just this whole like, you know, it's like okay, it's all right there. But I don't know. I it's just like this rose symbolism is just coming up again and again. So obviously, when I see a link between Pete Townsend, who to me seems like he's a total Rosicrucian, just with Tommy. Like you look at the symbolism of Tommy, and it's like repeatedly throughout the film, there's this Rosicrucian thing going on, and that's why you have turning away from the senses to find what's essential, and then you bring out what's essential into the world and into the senses. It's like it's a whole alchemical formula. You separate and you coagulate and you reunite, which is what happens with Tommy. And you can see, like, he's got the cube of space on his head, and he's looking around. He doesn't know where to go because he's in the cube of space. And then you have, the obviously, the crosses themselves with the rose in the center repeatedly throughout the film. And so it's just this whole thing, you know, and the dead father definitely, like, resonates Pink Floyd's The Wall, which you can see pretty directly. It seems like they were in communication, you know, somehow. They're from the same place, you know. They're both from Liverpool. Is that, am I correct to say that?
Mendes and Townsend?
No, well, Mendes, too. He sounds pretty English. I don't know. I was actually going to say Pink Floyd and The Who.
I don't know about that. That seems like something that would have stuck out. I mean, if Townsend, Pink Floyd, and the Beatles are all from Liverpool, like, what the fuck?
Liverpool, and the Beatles are from Liverpool. I don't know. Well, anyways, they're all from England. But they're still, like, they're basically huge in America. These English bands that come out all around the same time, and they just they blow up here. And then you find that there's so many, like, the way that they'll all play off of each other is really apparent. Obviously, like, it's making the weird link between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones being like the scarabs and the rolling dung balls.
So, I like that.
The
dung ball,
the scarab pushes, like, it's very much like the, because they're always playing off each other.
Yeah. You know, I mean, because, yeah, Sergeant Pepper's and then Satanic Majesties is a direct response. Let It Be, to Let It Bleed.
I incorrectly said something. In my mind, it was one thing, but when we were talking on Rosemary's Baby, I made a statement that Sergeant Pepper came out the same day as Satanic Majesties. It was Magical Mystery Tour came out the same day as Satanic Majesty's Request. Or is that, am I saying that right? Is it Satanic?
I think it speaks to the album that we don't know the title completely.
December 8th, the day that they came out, same year, same day, you know, but then that's the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the same day that John Lennon was shot. But then that's also the same day that Hotel California was released. I believe the single, made available for everybody, Hotel California, which is weird because there is the most fucking convincing backwards message I've ever heard in my life in Hotel California at exactly 2 minutes and 37 seconds from the back.
2 minutes, 37.
but the message, John Lennon by himself. I have replayed it over and over and over again, and it's they stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. They just can't kill the beast somehow. Say John Lennon by himself. John Lennon by himself. Super fucking weird. There's that, and then the other one is that at the very end of Dark Side of the Moon, Ticket to Ride. So during the heartbeat, turn it way the fuck up. And I'm not sure about the if all the versions have that. In fact, I doubt that they do. But certain versions of Dark Side of the Moon have fucking instrumental of Ticket to Ride playing.
Instrumental of Ticket to Ride. The song. Not like the words. The song.
The song. The melody of Ticket to Ride. Ever so faint at the very end.
And how'd you stumble across that?
Well, I stumbled across it because somebody else had it.
Yeah.
On YouTube and was like, what the fuck? But yeah.
Well, since we're in the middle of the music thing, and we started this with American Beauty, you know, to be honest, I didn't know that the cover of the Grateful Dead's American Beauty, the letters of beauty can be read, it's an ambigram. Have you ever noticed that?
I want to find it. Should have it right around here. Well, tell me more.
Well, I'll be interesting if you have the album. I'd like to see if you can.
I mean, if I can't spot it right now in my records, I can just look it up on the internet.
And yeah.
But what is it? What is it?
Since you got the internet, why don't you just punch up the image right now and see if you can read what it says? But I'm amazed that I had never heard of this fact. But I want to see if you can just see it yourself.
I mean, everything about that, I mean, what do you got on that album? Sugar, Magnolia.
Truckin'.
Yeah, that's like the quintessential Grateful Dead album. But then just that it is Grateful Dead, and then he's fucking, like, it's, you know, he gets the pineal gland headshot there at the end. Who did this quote? "We are watching several projections of a point moving in four-dimensional space. Unfortunately, we can't show all four dimensions in the picture at once, so we show more than one view and piece together the information in both panels to understand what is going on in four dimensions."
In the first comment that I put up there is a link to a math website. So it was just either a student or professor did this to try to explain the tesseract or the four-dimensional cube. And just seemed to apply to the whole magic.
So I'm looking at it. What do you think?
So at the bottom, do you see how it says American Beauty? At the bottom, beauty can be read a different way. It can also be American reality.
Yeah, I see that.
And apparently it was designed that way on purpose.
Is this Hypnosis? Do you know who did the cover?
This is Mouse Kelly.
Wow. What is the top one meant to be read in any other way? Where did you read that elsewhere, that was the intention?
Yeah, I did read that elsewhere.
Because I remember thinking that when I was younger, looking at the cover and being like, wow, it looks like it says reality.
So with, you know, I imagine that was completely on the mind of Alan Ball when he titled the movie American Beauty.
Uh-huh.
You know, the whole look closer. The American Beauty, the suburban, you know, beautiful house, all that whole thing that was, you know, demolished to death in the 90s in the last 10 years is look closer at the American Beauty, you get the American reality, and, you know, people got it hard everywhere, you know.
Yeah, it's like Blue Velvet when he pans down and goes and shows the white picket fence and then shows the worms beneath. The look closer sign was put there by the set designer, and after the fact became the slogan for the whole movie. You know, they liked it so much, you know.
Yeah, I love that. But you know, it's interesting with the Grateful Dead being such a powerful representative of American psychedelic rock and music, but so far behind in seemingly mainstream appreciation. I mean, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin, you know, they stopped making, I don't know, it seems like the Grateful Dead take a back seat to all that. And
well, depends on who you talk to.
It depends on who you talk to. So I would say maybe just like mainstream appreciation. And what you think, who drove the 60s and the 70s? You know, who were the people responsible for the choices and the aesthetics and all that stuff? And
right. Well, they're not a Brit invasion, meaning they weren't totally popular before they came to the U.S. because they were from the fucking U.S. And they toured in a completely different way that was more, you know, open and not as blown up. It was, there was another kind of authenticity there, and they were a true representation of themselves, and they didn't really want or go after the same kind of thing that the promoters of those other bands wanted, you know, for a fan base. They're also, I mean, that's, you talk about Rainbow Gatherings and Burning Man, those both came out of the Grateful Dead. I've old Deadhead friends who will verify, despite what anybody might, think or feel, like the people who originally went out to the desert for Burning Man, were Deadheads. That was where everything went, then it just went off in different directions. It's such a huge thing, they just want to open space to do their thing and to have their experience,
Which is what happens to the character ultimately in American Beauty at the end, shot through the head.
I really wanted to see the front of this album. I remember the black and white too having something. The fucking Red Rose. I forgot to put in Grateful Dead. I just put in American Beauty front, and then I get the her and the roses there. So good. But in he also, she was meant to be the Virgin Mary. What's her name? Mia Safari? Is that
Mina Suvari, I think, something like that.
yeah, she is modeled. Oh no. Well, yes, because she's the virgin, but then there's a simultaneous thing going on also with his daughter. And that when his daughter's sitting at the table with the roses in front of her, they're playing on this whole Mary symbolism, which also ties in with the rose pretty directly, Okay, here's the front. Because Grateful Dead is written the same way in black and white in the front, and then there's this kind of like there's the flowers that come up, but oh man, it's such a fucking perfect looking record. But it looks like Rick Griffin, the writing is like he came up with that, everyone just went with it. They were like, oh yeah, that's the style of writing. But
That script, that sort of.
script is a Rick Griffin script, which everybody took. It was just incredible, What the fuck is that picture? I want to find my own record, because the front of the album, or I don't know, actually this would classify as the back, excuse me, but the black and white other side of the record,
Holy
it's got
shit.
like
Yeah, I'm getting the image here.
these, it's so weird, ferns and whatever. It's got, I don't know what's going on there. Is that Jerry in the middle? I can't even tell. I need to get
Well,
a
it's
picture of.
interesting. Look at it. Looks like Jerry's head is, that shot in American Beauty where they show Thor Birch's face in the mirror, where Ricky Fitz is spying on the two girls in the bedroom, and Mina Suvari goes up to the window and starts to vamp a little bit, and you see Thora Birch turning away, but her face reflects in a little circular mirror. And the camera focuses in past the dancing virgin into the little circular mirror, and she smiles, And it kind of looks like little Jerry's head is in the same kind of circular mirror, kind of smiling back at us.
Yeah, there's a little butterfly down there, in between the E and the A, dead.
Yeah. But, I mean, God. The character of Ricky Fitz, I mean, I immediately thought of Stanley Kubrick's Boxes when I saw Ricky Fitz's room. He has the technology, he has the video camera because he's selling illegal substances. He has
Government,
government.
which is curious as to like where Ricky Fitz is getting his weed in the fucking first place.
To
You got
finance.
CIA.
Yeah, to finance his operation is government-supplied substance, and it's never explained. But his room is just wall-to-wall boxes of film, which reminds me of, Kubrick's Boxes. But, everyone thinks that it's seemingly absurd to have cataloged and categorized that much stuff into boxes, but with a modern day computer, I mean, you think about how much a computer saves and stores and automatically files for you. We probably have more information stored in our computers right now than Kubrick ever did. Right? Possibly.
Well, have you seen images of him with his Apple? Apple is so funny.
But, I mean, we are all little Kubricks with our own little boxes. I mean, we call them windows or we call them files, but, I mean, the idea that the average citizen, I mean, it could be crap in all those boxes, don't get me wrong. I'm not speaking to the content or the quality, but we all are carrying these records. I mean, if you want to go back and look at your internet history from 6 months ago, you pretty much can if you allow your computer to save that information. It's sort of a passive diary of where your brain was at on that day. I think of Ricky Fitz as being right on the cusp of the internet revolution. You know, it's like with a phone, people are taking more pictures, recording more video, they're storing it. They don't really know what they're going to do with it, but beauty seems to compel them to take out their phone or their camera or their video camera and to record it, to bring it to other people. Like, do you see this? Are you seeing this? You know, I mean, it's this very human desire, a very human reaction in an age of technology.
Right. And it's also the fact that you're recording and you have what's supposed to be a dead picture, but then in the film is all centered around recognizing life in what's supposed to be dead. That's the whole point. Like, you want to see the most beautiful thing I ever filmed, and this bag is just, it has this life behind. He says, this is when I notice there's entire life behind things and wanted me to know that there's nothing to ever be afraid of, ever. And so you have death itself being the source of all other fears, that without death, without the fear of death, there would be no other fear. Because that is a foundational fear. Because if you're not afraid of dying, then you have nothing else to be afraid of. So it's like, so you have that, and you have like basically that what we're watching in the first place is an extension of the same principle. Because he's showing that there's this, you know, that he's filming dead pictures, but then you're watching dead pictures of him filming dead pictures. So in a sense, it's a fractal in that way. But then also what we're doing right now is looking at how is there life in the thing that's supposed to be dead, which is the film in the first place. And then also recognizing that, you know, Kevin Spacey's character, who he's talking about, the last moment of his life is an eternity. And basically we're looking at somebody who's supposed to be shot right in like the seat of dream recording, like basically like your pineal gland is most activated in the middle of the night, right, while you're asleep. So it would be like mostly atrophied if it wasn't for that, because it what does it regulate melatonin, right? So basically it's excreting melatonin, from my understanding, or something along those lines, right? And so you're basically, all your dream imagery is completely related to the pineal gland, which is like the most medial point in the brain, right? So he gets shot directly in the back, and then his blood splatters all over the picture of his family, which is a dead picture, you know, which he's putting life into in the first place as he's watching it. And then you have, you know, the color of death being splattered all over that, and it doesn't change the fact. So it's like there's this like brutal fucking reality of death, and meanwhile, he's in an eternal moment. He's transcending all appearances. And so, like, it's completely connected. It could also be argued, this is a stretch, but I like it, when Ricky is watching the bag, that is actually, you know, John and Yoko's whole religion that they came out with.
Bagheads?
Which is bag.
Bagism. Bagism.
If you put a bag over yourself and so that people don't have any appearances to judge if you're having a communication. So just having to basically rely on what you're saying rather than on what you look like or any, race, so there's no racial prejudice. There's nothing to interfere with the communication. And so this is like another example of like we have all these layers that interfere with what's being communicated, where everything gets lost in translation. But then to have a direct communication, you have to drop all appearances, which is bagism, which is actually, in a sense, what Ricky Fitz is doing with his video, is he's being like, despite all appearances, where's the what's actually being communicated here? Because all you see is a bag fucking flying around in the wind. You know, what is that? Like
yeah, is there anything to when he says the G13, the government genetically engineered marijuana, no paranoia?
Right.
Why is that included? Why is that necessary? What is that component of it that if there's nothing to fear, right? Nature made this plant, right? But one of its side effects sometimes is paranoia. Right. Now, the government has come in, genetically altered it, and there's no paranoia. What is paranoia? It's fear. It's intense, sharp fear that seems to emerge out of nowhere, which if we're connecting it to death, then nature, as it intended, has this sort of joker card that can pop up and throw you into that spin. So... Kevin Spacey's character goes with the $2,000 an ounce paranoia free and turns on to these, you know, to this revolution in his self. So any point in focusing on a statement there that does that make the government positive? Has it improved nature's herb by juicing it up, making it stronger, taking away the paranoia? Or, I mean, what's going on there?
Well, what I find inevitably like more what I find really interesting is just the fact that he has some connection into government to receive this thing that it's wanted to be out there, and that you have like Tavistock and through Stanford University giving people psychedelics and then playing around with consciousness in that way. But basically that a lot of these bands you have the Grateful Dead had Owsley, right? And Owsley produced this LSD 25 business. It's the best acid came out of the Grateful Dead. But then you have the fact that, you know, this is all tied to government to a degree that, you know, we should recognize at this point. But these people got their acid through ultimately the government. That's just crazy. Like, it's not, I mean...
Where else would you get it?
Well, you can... People put it together and make it in laboratories and whatnot, but the best acid came from the government. And so, like, I don't know. I feel like there's something to be said for, you know, Ricky's character in that way and his dad's whole fucking trip out, like...
Well, his dad's a Marine, so he obviously knows... His dad knows people, so, I mean, you can build a bridge to the unknown, obviously, through that. I'm not telling you anything right. You don't know.
All these guys had military parents. Janis Joplin had military parents.
Jim really? Morrison did? Parents.
Like, yeah, a lot of these people actually had. And there's a whole thing that's written on Laurel Canyon and how they feel like it's this grand conspiracy, the fact that these people had military parents, that it's like it's not a mistake. You know, that these are the people influencing everybody and that maybe it was their parents who, but there's holes in that that aren't presented in the, in that whole theory, that it's as simple as that. I don't think it's as simple as that. I don't think that you know that Morrison's dad had planted, especially with how he what he was doing in Vietnam, pissing everybody off with his ship and not complying with his orders there, shortly before Morrison died. It's kind of, I don't know if I buy it, but I think that there is definitely something to be said for that. You have these children from military families having a huge influence on culture, and all coming out of the same place, Laurel Canyon. It's kind of weird. Is it a sink? I mean, I don't know.